Welcome to our weekly markets update from Chief Investment Officer Sonia Loud and her team here at Legal & General Investment Management. This episode was recorded earlier today and is intended for investment professionals.
Hello and welcome to our weekly CIO market update, our first on this new webinar platform. I'm Max Julius, Head of Content, and I'm delighted to be joined by Sonia Loud, CIO, Uday Patnaik, Head of Emerging Market Debt, and Eric Lud, Global Emerging Market Economist. Well, the tentative steps being taken globally towards reopening economies remain very much in focus, as do the options still available to policymakers after the initial rounds of fiscal and monetary stimulus. Sonia, on that note, could you please walk us through the current market and economic landscape?
With great pleasure, Max, and good morning, everyone. As always, I hope you're joining us well and safe. So as Max has already highlighted, it was very clear last week was dominated by news of countries announcing easing of restrictions. And as we all kind of were waiting, or we anticipated eagerly that this would happen, it's very clear now that trying to lift restrictions is fraught with complexities. And so I think as LGIM, we're trying to prepare going back gradually to the office. It's very clear that there's a lot of things we have to consider. And it's not just the commute, which it seems creates the most anxiety among people, but it's then the same. How do you organize office space? What is a safe number of people in the office? How should you think about, you know, the way people engage, interact? And then let's not forget just the fact that schools haven't opened yet, obviously, adds an extra layer of complexity. And we are seeing around the world how governments are trying to balance those complexities, because it's very clear that these are necessary to allow economies to reopen, while at the same time trying to balance a potential second wave. And in that context, we have had more news over the last week, particularly from Korea and China, where there have been pockets of re-emergence of the virus, which just show how complicated this is going to be. Now, it's very interesting as well to see there's one country in the Nordics that has attempted to establish a different framework, and obviously have only had a semi-lockdown, so to speak, because shops, schools, restaurants remained open, and its chief medical advisor to the government now seems to be a very well-respected global celebrity. I read an article earlier that, in fact, whereas a couple of months ago he would hardly get 10 journalists aiming to speak to him, I think he now attracted a global audience of more than 650 journalists, simply because his attempt to create a base immunity in Sweden obviously will be looked at very carefully to see whether this has been more successful than the very stringent lockdown measures that really brought the economy to a standstill in most other countries. Now, in terms of the virus update, and I'm particularly excited that this week we actually have live slides that you can look at while I'm speaking. So in terms of the virus update, again, it's a continuation of a similar pattern that we've discussed in the past. Obviously, the U.S. remains in focus because you can see very clearly from the top green line here, it's still more or less sideways moving. It's a flat line, and it's not declining as much as President Trump tries to tell us. And obviously, there has been a very interesting standoff between his chief medical advisor and himself in the context of how actually the U.S. is dealing with a pandemic. And we had a warning last night from the chief medical advisor that actually it would be premature to open the U.S. economy, and that actually a premature opening would worsen the pandemic. In that context, we have a very interesting news slide in our pack, which actually looks at the United States. And there's an interesting pattern, one would say, because it seems that obviously the severity of lockdown measures has been very different across U.S. states. And you can see that there's a political pattern running through it. And it's interesting how this will turn out to impact, obviously, Mr. President Trump's re-election campaign. But it's very clear now that in the U.S., we are seeing the crisis and the pandemic moving away from the coastal cities and actually hitting the heartland very much. So the next slide, I will not talk to, nor will I talk about the emerging markets, because we have two very distinguished emerging market experts on the panel. So it would be wrong for me to talk about this, and you will hear a lot more about emerging markets in a second. So let me briefly move on to the economic side of the equation before then finishing off with a few market thoughts. On the slide you're currently seeing, again, our economic scenarios have not changed, though it's very clear that we are getting a lot more real-time insights right now into how we should think about the economic trajectory on the back of eased restrictions. And as I said, this is why I started with the complexities. It's very clear that probably we have to be very flexible in our understanding, because there might be implications that will unfold that we haven't not that we have not yet baked into our assumptions. We've had a few very interesting snippets again last week. So global trade, for example, was down 27% in the second quarter, very much in line with obviously the flurry of negative headlines that we've had in terms of the economic picture. And very interestingly, closer to home, the first quarter GDP in the UK was down 2%. And the only reason why I'm mentioning it is it's down 2%, despite the fact that obviously we only had a few days in March where the full lockdown applied. But you see how quickly this obviously had a dramatic impact on economic activity. Now, to finish off with some market thoughts, it's very clear that obviously post the initial positivity against the backdrop of the enormous stimulus measures from governments and central banks, we've now kind of established a bit of a sideways pattern where daily news flow determines, you know, the trajectory of global markets. But the slide you're looking at now is an interesting one, because obviously it shows the dominance of the tech sector, not only in the United States, but globally. And in this context, I wanted to leave you with a very interesting observation and the research report that I read over the past couple of days, because it's not just the tech sector that is dominating the U.S. market. It is, in fact, only 6 stocks. And the composition of those original FANGs has changed a little bit, because it's now Facebook, Apple, Alphabet, Amazon, Netflix, and Microsoft. But the interesting takeaway from that study was that, yes, we know that these are dominant global franchises, and we know that they have been very successful. But what I thought was incredibly interesting is that if you were to exclude just these 6 stocks, then the U.S. market looks very much like everyone else's market. And I think that's the takeaway that is very interesting, because if you strip out those 6 stocks, the U.S. market, in fact, has flat earnings growth and sales growth under pressure. And again, something to think about, because then it means that the valuation levels that you're currently seeing in the U.S. are probably something to consider. So with that in mind, I would like to hand back to Max to then really delve into the emerging market topic, which we believe is incredibly interesting, and where, as you can see, we've spent a lot of time making sure we have a full picture and we understand the dynamics and how they differ from the developed world. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that update, Sonia. And yes, let's go to Eric now to talk EM. Eric, how have emerging market economies fared throughout the pandemic, and how do you expect them to evolve over the near and medium term?
Yeah, sure. Good morning, Max. Good morning, everybody. That's a good question. So if we look at the virus directly, so what has been the impact of the virus on emerging markets, they fare much better than advanced economies. So if you look at the number of fatalities, that's a relatively hard number. If you look at that, we find that fatalities in EM tend to be about 90% lower than in advanced economies. And this is always comparing at the same stage of the disease. Obviously, EMs are lagging DMs, and so you have to really make sure that you're comparing at the same stage of the disease. So let's say starting counting when death hit maybe 10 or something like that. So much lower fatalities there. Now, your first intuition might be, okay, these guys are not so good at recording death. Maybe their health system are more stretched and so on. They don't have the institutional capacity. But that is actually not the reason. The reason is that they just have a much more favorable age structure, We know that the virus particularly affects old people, people at pension age and so on. In emerging markets, we just have much less of those people as a share of the population. And so that's why we find much less fatalities there. We know the mortality rate by age, and so we can actually calculate a mortality rate for South Africa or a mortality rate from Italy, and it turns out that Italy's mortality rate is four times that of South Africa, just because there are so few old people in South Africa. And what does it mean? It means, yeah, these countries can probably lift their lockdowns earlier, which they are doing. The big exception here, and you can see this on the slide here, is Brazil. Brazil also has should have a very low mortality rate, and this is just an indication that the virus response there has been wholly inadequate, and the messages, particularly given by the president, have been wholly inadequate. Now, this was the virus. Of course, these countries will be affected by the collapse in trade and by capital outflows. But to be fair, of the 20 or so key emerging markets, we are only worried about a handful, specifically Turkey, South Africa, and then to a lesser extent Brazil and Colombia. So if you exclude those, the other ones, we think the outlook for the near and medium term is not bad, actually. We think that the sell-off in some of these has gone really too far, and that the outlook is quite good. You know, in terms of asset classes, in asset allocation, we probably like credit somewhat more than currencies. That's why when we go into currencies, we tend to do a relative currency trades in the EM universe.
That's very interesting. And on currencies specifically, I mean, as you've just suggested, so in light of their different circumstances and challenges that you've highlighted, how is the asset allocation team positioning in FX?
Yeah, so as I hinted, in FX, we like particularly relative currency trades. The reason for that is that, there will be big fiscal stimulus also in emerging markets, and some emerging markets have already and will also use quantitative easing to absorb some of this issuing of government paper, and that's fine, I think. Many of these countries have proven they have a strong track record, and investors will tolerate that, but still it keeps us a little bit cautious, and that's why we prefer relative currency trades. And yeah, along with what I told you earlier, which countries we like and which countries particularly we don't like, for example, we have a short Brazilian real, and we pair that with a long Indonesian rupiah. So we like the Indonesia story a lot from many angles. We have a short South Africa trade and a long ruble trade. I mean, Russia really is a fortress. It's very hard to find issues with their macroeconomic approach. Long ruble, short South Africa, and also short Colombia, and again ruble on the long side. The only one where we have a outright short really is Turkey, and they have a lot of issues internally, externally, politically. That's a few of our trades in asset allocation.
Good. Well, thank you for that, Eric. Well, let's go to Woody now and take a longer-term view. So, Woody, how are emerging market fundamentals today different to how they were during the global financial crisis?
Great. Yeah. Hi, everyone. First of all, what I would say in terms of nominal economy and GDP per capita in PPP terms, so EM economies are now approximately 70% larger than in 2008. And what this means is you have greater wealth, a broader middle class, lower levels of poverty and more shock absorption capacity. So the question is, you know, how did this happen? How did these economies grow over the last 10 years? And really that's in large part due to significant reforms. So first of all, I would mention exchange rate flexibility. Number two would be, for example, the local bond market reform. So what you see now is an increasing number of countries that are included in the various indices. Number three, I would say that definitely an improvement in the regulatory quality of the banking sector. And I would also have to mention governance. And specifically, if we look at, for example, the World Bank and the IFC doing business indicators, and take China as an example, that during 2009, China was ranked number 90 out of 181 countries, and it's currently ranked around 31 out of 190 countries. Similarly, India back then was ranked 122. It's now 63. And if we move on, for example, to Turkey, it was ranked 59, now 33, et cetera, et cetera. And the final thing I would just mention on this, it's not just the large EM economies that have benefited over the last 10 years, but this is really, this improvement has permeated to lower income countries. And by that, I mean countries like Ethiopia, Rwanda, Angola. And over the last 10 years, what you've seen is these countries have received credit ratings. With that, they've worked more closely with the IMF. And have IMF programs, and that also means greater transparency for investors.
Thank you for that important context, Woody. Moving on to positioning, how are you positioning within EMD? Where do you see the most opportunities, both in outright terms and versus G4 rates and, say, US investment-grade credit? And just to tag on to that question, we've just had a question in from one of our viewers about the US dollar. So how do you expect EM currencies to fare versus the greenback?
Okay, great. So there's a lot in there.
There is, yeah.
Okay. So let me start with this. I've been investing in emerging markets fixed income for about 30 years. In my opinion, this is one of the top three investment opportunities, the other two being the 98 Russia crisis and the global financial crisis. So one of the reasons I wanted to get on this call with Sonia and Eric is really to highlight that, you know, a lot of the clients who I speak to over the years, and I've spoken to hundreds, a lot of them feel that, you know, last year they missed the rally. What I'm saying is, in my opinion, this is a fantastic time to get involved in EM fixed income. Just looking at the slide that you have in front of you, hopefully, what you have is that in March, we had the second worst monthly performance in the last 20 years in EM, okay? Just a, you know, massive fall. And with that has come a lot of opportunity. Okay. And, you know, what you see is, as well, is that the spread now of, let's say, EM hard currency sovereign debt versus G4 rates is among, it's really around the highest that it's been for about two decades. Now, obviously, yields were higher back in 2000, but of course, the 10-year Treasury, believe it or not, used to be at 6%. But if you look at that outright spread, which is a dark blue line that hopefully you can see versus the G4, you see that's a massive spread. Okay, so in terms of how we're positioned, this is the longest, as you would imagine, that, you know, we've been for several years versus our beta. Okay, we prefer hard currency debt here to local currency. And just to quickly answer that question on the dollar, I prefer hard currency credit versus local markets here. Several reasons. Number one, if you look at the yield, for example, on the hard currency indices, it's about, let's say, 6.5%. The yield on EM local markets is about 4.7%. Okay, so this differential is the most significant between hard currency and local that it's ever been. Now, the issue here is that a lot of the rate cuts have already been priced into EM. I don't think you're going to make much more money on the rates leg of the trade. So then you're left with basically the currency aspect of it. And look, I just don't hate the dollar here. right? I'm not saying that, you know, I do think the dollar is in the process of building a top, but you're picking up an extra 3% or so just going into hard currency on the yield basis versus local markets. So if you go into EM local, and I'm just using EM local as a generic asset class, not, you know, not country specific, is that you really have to believe that you're going to get a pretty big boost from a basket of EM FX versus dollar. I don't see that today. So in terms of positioning, okay, this is the highest beta we've been running. What do we like here? We have been migrating toward investment grade EM basically since middle of March. And why is that? Frankly, it's easy pickings, right? We have quality IG bonds, for example, where from even current levels, and we have tightened on the indices about 130 basis points since March 23rd, but in my opinion, we have between 50 to 200 basis points potential of spread tightening in some, you know, quality IG names. So where we're overweight right now is we like Indian quasi-sovereign debt. Okay, this is government-owned, 50% or more. We also like in Latin America, we like Panama, okay, sovereign debt. In the Middle East, we have a preference for Qatar and Abu Dhabi and select investment grade quasis and financials there. Away from IG, what we do still like is we like Ukraine sovereign and select corps. We like the India renewable energy sector, which is doing phenomenally well, especially in the last week. And we also like short-dated China real estate, the higher quality names. And, you know, just I think one of the questions was, you know, sort of oil versus non-oil. We have been migrating, really from March till about a week ago into sort of non-oil names, right? So I mentioned India, oil importer, Panama, an Indian importer. An oil importer, sorry. And even with the Abu Dhabi, et cetera, you know, we migrated from the weak oil names into the stronger oil names. That said, over the last week, we are nibbling at some sub-IG oil names as well, as I do believe oil has formed a bottom here. And over the next 6 to 12 months, oil will go higher. So we've been adding a little bit, for example, of Pemex here, some Ecopetrol in Colombia, which is government-owned, and names like that.
Brilliant. Well, thank you for that compelling case you've laid out for the asset class, and actually for preempting one of our later questions about the oil price moves. Let's just have some quick fire final questions now. Move back to Eric. So, Eric, how do you think the pandemic might impact long-term investment themes for EM, say, could it trigger a rethinking of social contracts towards big government, in your view?
I think this theme that you are mentioning, I think it's probably more relevant for advanced economies. The reason why I say that is that emerging markets tend to have larger informal sectors, and they are harder to tax, and that's why I think they will maintain leaner governments there. It's just harder to finance big governments. It's harder to finance them there than in advanced economies. So on top of that, the informal networks and also the closer family bonds that you have tend to have in emerging markets also make an insurance role of the government less important than in advanced economies where you have more nuclear families and so on, less informal networks. So I don't think that that's a particularly relevant theme, but that doesn't mean that I don't think that the virus is going to change, leave its mark and throw up new investment themes. I mean, one theme, for example, would be diversification away from China. I mean, this was definitely already a theme that was ongoing given the uncertainty that Trump's trade war against China had created. There was already it was already becoming more and more difficult for international companies to invest there. But I think this is definitely going to be reinforced, this theme through the virus that people want to diversify their production chains away from one single country, and countries that could benefit from that are clearly manufacturing powerhouses in the region like Vietnam, Malaysia, Thailand, and so on. I think just very quickly, another one, of course, is the damage to livelihoods and the rise in inequality that we have seen in emerging markets that could lead to increase in populism. I know we know that this is not something that only befalls EM, but it's definitely something that we also have to be very aware of, that could happen in emerging markets.
Well, thank you for that, Eric. And geopolitics is absolutely creeping back into focus right now. So just before we turn back to Sonia to finish up, in a minute, I'm just going to put to you guys the question of debt forgiveness, which is rearing its head again for EM.
Yeah, I can talk about that really quickly. We've obviously been spending just an enormous amount of time having discussions with the IIF, other multilateral bodies, various central banks, countries like Sri Lanka, some African countries, et cetera. Look, from what we can gather is, okay, point number one would be that the countries would specifically have to ask for this. Now, the issue is, and what we're really talking about, is a lot of the sub-Saharan African countries for most part. The problem here is that, well, it's a good problem, that they virtually have zero maturities this year in the external debt market, okay? And the coupons that are due, again, are minimal. And I think what's happened over the last week, especially when we've talked to the central banks in these countries, they've also realized that really there's very minimal savings to do any sort of restructuring. And even with sort of a restructuring, what the IIF is basically proposing and the IMF is something where you don't take a haircut. It's NPV neutral. And most of the savings, frankly said, would be on bilateral debt. And look, I hate to bring this up, but it's China, right? That if you look especially on the African continent, a lot of the debt, whether it's in Angola, Kenya, Zambia, it's with China. Right, and it can be as high as 50% of the debt, and I think that's where a lot of the focus really is going to be, rather than with bondholders. So my probability of this, going to sort of bondholders over the at least for this year, would be something like 15-20%.
Right. Well, thank you for that reassuring view there, Woody. So, moving back to Sonia now, our final question, as EU-UK trade talks resume, Brexit is back in the headline. Could the talks sway UK and Euro area assets over the near term, or will they continue to pale into significance when compared to the pandemic? And is there anything else you'd like to add before we wrap up this morning?
They're always good to end on a cheerful topic. So Brexit obviously has been obviously away from our radar for the whole period ever since obviously we entered lockdown. But we should not forget that it's obviously June 30th, which is the next deadline, when in fact they have to agree an extension. And it's very interesting because literally talks just resumed in the short term, obviously via virtual video calls. So again, obviously what means the means we need to use to communicate with our clients, and obviously as our lives change, the same is true for the Brexit negotiations. And it's clear that very early on, again, the kind of contentious points, fisheries came up a couple of times in the press I've seen. And there's other areas that will be part of the very fraught negotiations. It's interesting that I saw that there might be a preference just to not ask for an extension and literally just leave the EU just to avoid any uncertainty. But that's really just a newspaper article. I think there will be a lot more we will hear. It's a good question whether it will actually influence asset prices, given obviously the overwhelming impact that economic news will have on asset prices. But we should not forget, and I think this is something we have raised last time as well, you know, there is a lot of global geopolitical tensions out there that, yes, have taken kind of a step back in the global pandemic discussion, but they have not been resolved. And obviously the US-China trade tensions and Brexit are key areas to watch. And obviously later in the year, we will head towards the US election, where very much the trade negotiations with China will come back to the fore. So lots to think about. But I think in the near term, and what you heard again today, it's very clear that the understanding of the economic implications differs a lot depending on the region, the country, the sectors you're looking at. And it very much echoes what we've picked up over the series of our client calls that we're doing every week, that it is really about the understanding of the virus developments and the economic impact that will provide us with the right insights to define investment opportunities. So I will leave you with that thought. It's very clear that there's a lot that we have to digest here in the UK over the coming weeks once we try to lift restrictions. But I hope you find this you found this useful, and please do let us know if there's anything else you would like to hear from us.
Well, thank you, Sonia, Woody and Eric, for your time today. I'd like to thank all of our clients for logging and dialing in. You can find us here the same time next week when Sonia will be joined by Ben Bennett and Tim Drayson, who appeared on our very first call back in March.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.